She's going to pretend she's something she's not. And I was like, no, I'm Jewish and I'm proud to be Jewish. They went on that journey with me.
We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am.
Here I am.
Here I am.
And here I am with Shai Davidai.
My guest today is a Sephardic Jew, a spoken word artist, and someone who has appeared multiple times on Deaf Poetry Jam. She's also one of the most optimistic and happy people that I've met in the past 2 years, which might come as a surprise to you.
That is a surprise.
I have met some
See,
pessimistic
Mom, I'm
people.
Not so negative.
So here I am with Vanessa Hidari.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm good. I put this out into the universe that I was going to be on this show, and here I am.
Well, here we are, and it wasn't a question in my mind. Like, you know, we just had to make it happen, and we're making it happen. So, Vanessa, we're going to start with the same question that we start every episode. Vanessa Hidari, what kind of a Jew are you?
What kind of Jew am I? I am a proud, unapologetic Jew.
Proud, unapologetic.
Yes.
Why does that even need to be stated, unapologetic?
Because I feel like a lot of times there's... kind of this, if you're going to be so proud, you have to have a little bit of like, you know, be humble about being Jewish, about being, it's not something that I always saw around me. So I stood out in that way, and that I was just kind of relentlessly proud. And I think, especially in my work, I think that there are not that many people talking about being Jewish in the genre that I was in of spoken word, that sometimes don't have a little bit of an apologetic twist to it.
Yeah, so let's, I want to hear a lot about your work, but just explain to people, what is spoken word artist? Like, what is it that you do? How are you, is that different from a poet or an actor or actress?
Right, so spoken word poetry is, it's sometimes it's called slam poetry, which is like the competition of poetry where literally you go into a room, you perform, and the audience, random people in the audience are picked as judges, and they hold up numbers from 1 to 10 judging you.
No anxiety there. Random yeah. People holding numbers judging you.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good way to kind of toughen you up a little bit, especially I was coming from the acting world where, you know, everyone was so much more careful about like feedback and this and that. And this scene was like, you're good, you suck. Like you just knew right away what to expect. So it was, you know, so it'd be a competition. And at the end, whoever had the highest scores, the average would be the slam, the winner of the slam. Performance, poetry, spoken word, I would say it very much, it comes from like the beatnik kind of performing poetry. So it has a rhythm to it and from hip hop. So I kind of came into it more from being a big fan of old school hip hop and finding the scene that was most kind of connected to that. So it had a rhythm to it and it had a certain energy and a pride to it that I was really attracted to.
When did you start and how, I guess?
So it's interesting because I was set on being a Hollywood actress. Like I was like, I want to be the next Meryl Streep. I was so like, okay, this is what I'm going to do. I went to, I got my master's. People don't know this about me, that I got my MFA in acting from a conservatory in Providence, Rhode Island, called Trinity Rep. And so I was, you know, and then I did Shakespeare in the summer and I was on track to be a serious actress. While I was at grad school, I also, I mean, I always loved writing, but I started writing a little bit more there, and I started getting a little bit of attention for my writing. At the time, I didn't really see how to combine the two, and I thought, well, I don't want them to just push me into the writing category. I'm an actress. And
I want to be in front of the camera, not behind it.
Yeah, I want to be in front of it, and I also, you know, every time you're at like a grad school, people try to kind of place you as like, you're the this, you're the that, you're the comedic actress, you're the serious one. And I always felt like I could do all of it, and that I kept getting pegged as the comedic, quirky one, which I know is probably strange for most of the people who hear my work now, because it has not been funny for 2 years. But I guarantee you guys, I have a lot of comedy that I've done, and I used to be really funny. But I always felt like I was never being seen the way, I saw myself. So people didn't even know how to cast me. Like, they would always cast me as the role that no one else could play. And I wanted to be Juliet. I wanted the pretty girl, 25-year-old roles that other girls were getting. And with me, if it was like, you know, most of the people are young in grad school, but there's got to be someone to play like the old person, Inga the fish woman. I had to play someone that was like mute and like didn't walk. Like, anytime there was like any odd role that no one, they didn't know what to do with, I got it. And at the time, I was really angry about it, but I think that it gave me a lot of character. And they gave it to me because I could do those things, even when I always said that I was kind of, you know, I was 25 and I looked a certain way on the outside, but on the inside, I was like George Burns. I was like this, like, I feel like this old sarcastic, like Jewish guy, like with a cigar, like even from when I was younger, I had all these different personalities, but you couldn't see it on me, which is perfect breeding for writing your own material, because then you're casting yourself. So I started writing my own monologues just to audition with, because again, I couldn't find anything to audition with. It's funny because I started wanting to bring my Jewish identity into my work.
Why? Well, and I know it's weird to ask why.
No, but it was definitely a watershed moment, because I lived in New York, grew up on the Upper West Side my whole life. So I was around Jews my entire life and all different ethnicities. And I thought everyone grew up like that. And then I went and I moved to New England, and I was like, oh my God, I'm so Jewish. And I didn't even realize that my humor was Jewish. Everything that, you know, just the way I went through life. And so it started coming out of me more. So I started writing. I wrote like a piece about meeting my first WASP, like my first white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. And so I started kind of playing around with that. And I was also very interested in representation of culture. I had been around all these other ethnicities, and I had been seeing the way other people celebrated their heritage. And I wanted to find a way into mine, but I hadn't quite found the place yet. And so when I graduated, I was writing my own monologues and stuff, but I still hadn't found the spoken word scene. And when I found the spoken word scene, I went to this, it was an exhibit, the Brooklyn Museum. Deaf Poetry Jam hadn't come out yet, but they were doing like the pilot show for it. And I went to the show and I saw it and I said, oh my God, that's it. That's it. Because it brought together my love of hip hop, the rhythm, the energy, and the people that didn't have to look like exactly what they were saying. And I think very early on, and I'm so glad that I did it, the whole casting part of acting was something that I couldn't do. Like, every time there was an audition and they were like, okay, come be this like pretty girl who lives in like Connecticut, whatever. Like, and I would freak out anytime that I had to look and play a certain role or what type I was. And
you wanted to be yourself.
I wanted to be myself. And at that time, it just like no one was really, you know, it just wasn't. And the material that was out there for Jews was like a lot of, you know, like Brandeis University, like college girls. That was some of the material. There was nothing that was an urban Jewish girl that grew up with Puerto Rican and Dominicans and Blacks and loved hip hop. Like that was like, and I was like, where is that whole niche? And I was like, well, I guess I better create it. So when I saw the spoken word scene, I was like, oh my God, I can talk about being Jewish in a loud, proud way. That's the genre. And doesn't matter what I look like. And I always just felt like I didn't want to rely on looks with my career. Like, I mean, if that was there, that's great. But I didn't want to have to be like, okay, I have to look this way to go in this audition and this and that. It really had to be based on who I was inside. And I'm really glad I made that decision. And it worked for me. I mean, my friends thought I was crazy because there were no, you know, Jewish girls in that scene really doing that.
The scene was really just nascent. It was a new scene at the time, so forget about Jewish girls in the scene.
Yeah, there were, and also there are different genres, like there are different like kind of cliques in the poetry scene. And the one that I went to was mostly the kind of very, It was mostly like Black and Latin, very hip hop based, not as like quirky and kind of comedy as some other scenes were. So I went right into the scene that was probably the harder scene for me to get myself into. But it felt so natural because that was how I grew up and that was what attracted me to that scene in the first place.
Do you remember your first time performing spoken word?
Yeah. So I had this piece called Culture Bandit and I wrote it and it started out like as a prayer for my neighborhood and it started with Baruch Ata Adonai, Viva Puerto Rico Ha'olam, Hamotzi, fight the power, main haaretz, amen. And I was like,
what was the reaction? Like, obviously, yeah. I think I understood all the words, but I'm not sure. But like, you're performing to an audience that's mostly non-Jewish.
Yeah.
What were the looks on people's faces?
It was just kind of, I think with that one, it was more like, funny, giggly, like kind of like, oh, because any time that you would do something Jewish, it was, you know, people didn't know how to react really, you know. And I think that they were, it was something very different. And that piece was a little bit, I felt like more in the fun genre. Then the piece after that that became my signature piece was a piece that is called Hebrew Mamita. And it's like, you don't look Jewish. You don't act Jewish. What does Jewish look like to you? And I'm like, should I fiddle on a fucking roof for you? And should I humor you with oyves and refuse to pay? Because you know how we like to Jew you down. And I would do this piece. And now before people knew me, I wouldn't announce at the beginning of the poem, I'm going to do a piece where I'm going to be Jewish. So I would get up and people had no idea what I was going to say. And when I would get to the part where I would say, oh, funny, you don't look Jewish. You don't act Jewish. And that was a line of someone saying that to me. The crowd would get so silent. And
what kind of silence is it? And I have to say, so this is a piece, the Hebrew Mamita,
yeah,
that went viral, been watched hundreds of thousands of
yeah.
times. You performed it on Deaf Poetry Jam.
I did.
And it's interesting because you can feel the tension.
Even when you're watching the video. Yes,
because the piece starts with you sitting at a bar.
Yeah, I'm like, meet a guy at a bar, right. He's cute, you know what I mean? And then I tell him that I'm you know, Jewish, though, and I can't do something because I'll be fasting for Yom Kippur. And he's like, you're Jewish?
Right, and I think at that moment, the audience also goes through the same
part.
She's Jewish?
Yeah.
Because you, quote unquote, don't look Jewish.
Right, right. So there's an idea of that. Then there's also, on top of it, the energy and the scene, and the poem goes on with being very, like, you know, like I said, should I fiddle on a fuck? It's very strong. So there's not only that people are looking at me like, oh, she, we're not, we weren't sure she was Jewish by the way she looks, but we're not used to seeing Jews talk like this. Yeah. And be so, that's why I said unapologetic, proud, this and that. And that, I mean, I would say that was amazing. That got me, I feel like, so much respect, because if there's one thing that the poetry scene, in the time where it was really good for me, was that that kind of honesty and celebrating who you are and not trying to be something else. And I think the expectation was when they saw someone white going up there, they were kind of like, oh, okay, this white girl's gonna get up here. She's gonna kind of try to be black. She's gonna be blah, blah, blah. She's gonna pretend she's something she's not. And I was like, no, I'm Jewish and I'm proud to be Jewish. And people were, you know, they went on that journey with me, and I kind of, you know, I became known for that, and I got a, you know, a lot of respect for that. And but it was, there would be this silence in the room that I became addicted to that wasn't good or bad. It was just this uncomfortable silence. And that, you know, kind of started out my career there. And
why did you call that piece the Hebrew Mamita?
Oh God. This is one of the things that I was like, am I gonna talk about this? Okay.
You don't have
so,
to.
No, it's cool. Maybe it's just best that I just so I'll try to give an abbreviated version. So it kind of goes with, so how I grew up, as I grew up on the Upper West Side, and all my friends growing up were Latino, mostly Puerto Rican, Dominican, all different nationalities. But I kind of found myself very, spending a lot of time with the Latino community. So when I started writing and stuff, I thought I would kind of be an honoring, like how I grew up in the neighborhood, and I wasn't the only Jew like that. There were a lot of us that were like that. I was like, I'm gonna give honor to my diverse neighborhood, and I'm gonna mix something Jewish with something Latin. And my whole life, people would call me, hey, mamita, hey, mommy, all those things. And so it felt very natural. Now, what happened was, I called myself that, and it was really fun. But then some people then were either thinking I was half Latina, half Jewish, and that became confusing. And then came the politically correct police that when I first started writing, I felt like I had a lot more, and thank God, but there was a lot more openness and less being careful about, you know,
more freedom, because
there was
people weren't being canceled for.
Yes, there was an artistic freedom. And it, from me, it always came from a place of love with that. And the people who knew me and knew how I grew up, they were like, that's so you, that's so natural. You grew up with like all Latinos and it was like a perfect combination. But as the years went on, language got a lot more, you can't say this, you can say that. And I mean, it just kind of got to the point that after like a few years ago, I just decided to not use the name anymore because I felt like it was just too confusing and times change. And when I first started, I felt as though it was almost like a superhero and something that I felt like I was giving respect to these cultures that I grew up with. And then instead, certain people were seeing it as being disrespectful by kind of,
right,
you know, taking advantage, I don't know.
And we'll get to the policing in the scene.
So,
but before that, I do want to ask you, what was so triggering about being told you don't look Jewish? What was the so passionate about that, that you, I'm going to tackle that?
Well, because like I said in my poem, I used to say that I took it, that in my mind, I would kind of be like, thank you. And that it was a compliment that was the way I internalized it. When people would say to me, "You don't look Jewish," I was like, oh, I'm getting away with something, because I knew that the stereotype for Jewish women from the people that especially that it was coming from was not positive. So it really made me question myself in terms of the internalized anti-Semitism that I had of this image of Jewish women not being pretty or being a certain energy, this and that. And so I felt like I was kind of passing in a certain way. And I also realized, and you know, it never quite went away, but people were always like, you know, Vanessa's Jewish, but she's cool.
Yeah.
And I still have that in one of the pieces that maybe I'll read later. But that was constantly the energy. And so I wanted to bring that into my work, and that I wanted to be like, well, being Jewish is cool. And not only that, but I think that people just haven't seen enough of like all these different kinds of Jews. And like I said, I grew up like this, and there were other Jews that grew up like me. In, you know, into hip hop on the Upper West Side. I grew up, my parents were public school teachers. It was the Upper West Side is very different from what it is now. Very mixed neighborhood, a kind of, you know, you were taking a chance. My dad bought a brownstone there when the neighborhood was like really sketchy. And it was this time of, and it's not a mistake that it was Jews and other groups. And we could get to it, but that's kind of became the product of, my daughter became a product of that and my neighborhood. And so I didn't realize until I left New York that people didn't know about this, right. You know, me. And I felt like it was really important because there was a stereotype, and I still feel like it's not fully there, you know, and I still go through life where people are like, oh, you know, you don't seem Jewish. And there's such an idea of that. So I really wanted to tackle it.
And you mentioned your daughter, and I think, it really is actually very interesting because you describe your daughter as a Juminicana.
Juminicana, right.
She's, so explain that.
So the Jewish is from me. And her father, David, is, his family's from the Dominican Republic. And he also grew up on my block. So we grew up across the street from each other. His family owned the bodega on the corner. Funny enough, my best friend's family growing up, that was the Puerto Rican family, her family owned that bodega before David's family. And it's actually really a part of the immigration process here, because the Puerto Rican community came first and then the Dominican community. So my friend, shout out to Leticia Mangual and her family, the Mangual family, they owned the bodega there. I grew up there playing Pac-Man, Lady Pac-Man in the back. I was like, this is the coolest thing that your parents own a bodega. My parents are public school teachers. Wow. Like, this is like so much more fun what your parents do. And then they ended up selling that to the next wave of of immigrants, which was David's family. So,
and if you go back, you know, the Jews came to New York City and started the delis.
Right.
Right.
So, right.
So you got the delis, then become the bodegas. You know,
Yeah.
It's a story of immigration.
And so it is, you know, a special place in my heart. And that, again, had so much to do with my upbringing and who I am, because I literally grew up in that. And I spent Christmas Eve with the Mangual family. And I just feel so lucky that I was able to have all those different experiences, and they took me in like I was their own.
Right. But something about that, you know, the diversity is so beautiful and interesting. And yet, I assume when your daughter grows up, she will also get the, you don't look Jewish.
Oh.
She She's a Jewish black Latin.
Yeah, she's woman. You know, she is, you know, Afro-Latina. And she already, it's happened actually, because when I, one time I went to a doctor's appointment when she was just a baby, and they gave me some form, and like some of the stuff was already filled out on it. And I looked, and I didn't even know that there was a slot on this, on certain forms for religion, and it said Christian on it. And I have to tell you, my body had such a reaction. Not because there's anything wrong with that, but I was like, my daughter, and someone had filled it in for me. And I was, you know, and I marched up to, I said, someone fill this out for me. You know, my daughter is Jewish, or they're probably looking at me like I was crazy. They were like, I don't know. We didn't fill it out, but someone filled it out, and it wasn't me and it wasn't David. So I kind of feel like that's already started in a way. And yes, it's going to be, I think that's why I'm trying to, you know, instill that in her so much now, but yes, she'll go through that even more than I will.
And unfortunately, you know, the internalized stereotypes affect us so much that she might even go through that from Jewish people saying you don't look Jewish.
Oh, for sure.
And which brings me to you created a project called the Kaleidoscope Project.
Yeah.
What's the Kaleidoscope Project?
So this is this is before I had my daughter. It was you know, aside from all the diversity that I grew up around, so my mother's family are Syrian Jews from Aleppo, and my father's family is Ashkenazi Russian. But when I remember even growing up that, you know, we would go to Ocean Parkway in Brooklyn, and the food and the customs were completely different. So we would have like sambusak and minjedra and all this food that was different. And all anyone knew in the Jewish community growing up, if you grow up in you know, the States as an American Jew, everything is bagel, lox and cream cheese, gefilte fish, matzo ball soup. And that's what you're associated with. All the last names are, you know, Ashkenazi last names, this and that. And so I really wanted to, I could see that there was a need in the community to start talking more about Jews, Mizrahi Jews, Sephardic Jews, Jews that were, you know, biracial Jews, interfaith Jews, converts. And so I made this show that was basically a smorgasbord of Jews. And I was like, anyone who wants to come tell their story about, you know, being a diverse Jew, you know, come and send me your stories.
This is your opportunity.
Yeah. And so
what kind of stories did you get? How was it?
Oh, amazing. We had, I had like a Libyan Jew. I had an Ethiopian Israeli Jew who had moved to New York. And you have to understand, when I'm doing this show, which I would say it hasn't changed that much now, I made sure that, 'cause a lot of times here when you do things in the Jewish community, only the Jewish community comes. So,
Unfortunately.
And so one of the things that I've had, you know, what I feel like I've been blessed with, which is kind of hard now because now it's changed a little bit that we'll get into, is that so much of my audience has been the diversity of who I was growing up. So the spoken word scene obviously was very diverse and this and that. So I invited everyone to come to the show and they were absolutely shocked. They had no idea that there were like Jews of color, you know, brown Jews, black Jews, Moroccan Jews, Latin Jews. They had no idea. And I was like, oh my God. And this is like before October 7th. So I remember already being like, this is something that we really need to work on in the community. And I can't, and now after October 7th, it's even more of, I feel like an urgency to kind of, you know, educate
right.
Everyone with that. But that was, and it was amazing. I got these great stories and it was you know, just kind of a real celebration, and people talked about different foods and different customs, and it was amazing. Yeah.
That's great. That's great. So how would you describe your life before October 7, 2023?
Well, it's interesting because I know now people are using this term like the October 8th Jew, and I'm definitely not like an October 8th Jew because I was already talking about being Jewish. I feel like I'm like a 7 3/4 Jew or something. Like I have to have my own title for it because I was already obviously performing and talking about being Jewish and about anti-Semitism. But I always instinctively knew that when Israel came up to kind of like slowly exit the room.
But just to paint a picture, like yeah. You are, you know, before October 7, what were your circles, your social circles? Who were your quote unquote people?
Artistic, very artsy, left progressive art scene. And when I say art scene, it was a lot of times in the spoken word scene, it was musicians, poets, comedians. There was like a whole underground, you know, actors, artist scene. So I would say, and I would say that it was diverse. I would say that probably a majority at a certain time was Black and Latino. But I always had, you know, Jewish community as well because I was also performing. It was funny because I never intended to really perform for the Jewish community. I just wanted to be in the spoken word scene and talk about me. And then the Jews like found me, and then it was amazing because then I started, you know, performing at federations and talking and stuff. So I had all those circles at once. But I would say my social circle was probably more in that artistic scene. And also all the causes and the things that, you know, all the social justice things that I, you know, was very involved in.
And yet you knew that when Israel comes up, you kind of like close your mouth.
Yeah.
Walk away.
You know, there would be like, you know, we never had anything that lasted so long. So there would be like a little like, you know, kind of incident, I would say, that would happen in Israel. And I feel like there would be like a week or so, like I say it, one of my pieces of like rumblings about it. But it's a funny story, actually, because about 12 years ago, so way before this, I was going to be featured at a spot up in Washington Heights. This Dominican guy was featuring me up there. And somehow, and this is before Instagram, so they put it on Facebook. And a girl, when she saw that I was being featured and I was this Jewish poet and whatever, she went and Googled me and she saw that I had worked, because I had worked for Birthright Israel and I had done a monologue show for Birthright Israel, which kind of became the basis for Kaleidoscope. So I had gotten into that helping other Jews tell their stories and being on the other side of things in terms of being director, teacher of, you know, this kind of storytelling being a really important part of, you know, Jewish, you know, pride and storytelling. So she put up a whole post about that she couldn't believe that they were featuring a Zionist.
So 12 years ago.
12 years ago.
We're talking 2013.
Yeah.
14, yeah. And so she Googled you, she saw, and she realized
Birthright Israel. It's funny, there was a picture of me. There was a picture of me at like this Israeli event. And I have to understand at the time, I don't even know. I was like, you know, younger. And there's a picture of me in this, like in this sexy top, like draped around these two Israeli guys with like Israeli flags. And so she took that picture out. I was like, oh my God. She took that picture and posted it, me with the Israeli flags, and she was like, "You're featuring a Zionist."
And back then, that was already like a no-no.
Well, no. The funny thing that I say is that at the time, except for a few people or whatever, but for the most part, most people didn't know what a Zionist was. It wasn't like it is now.
They still don't know what a Zionist is.
They still don't. But the term hadn't been hijacked. It wasn't a slur. It wasn't anything. So the funny part is that people were like, we don't understand what she's calling you. Like, what is going on? Like, we like Vanessa. We don't know what, like, you're talking about. And it was kind of ironic because most of the poems I was doing at that time, aside from the one poem about being Jewish, I was doing poems about breakups with getting my heart broken by a guy, about this and that. I had a lot of poems about dating, about this and that. So people were very confused. It didn't go anywhere. I ended up going and do the show. Nothing happened. Again, because I feel like people also weren't really attuned to the Zionist thing. So it kind of went away. And then that girl found me, like, you know, this many years later after October 7th, and put... she found me on a picture of me on someone else's page, and she was like, I remember you. And she put like the red Hamas triangles like underneath my pictures. Wow. And at the time, I didn't even know what the triangles were yet. And when my Israeli friend was like, oh, you know what that is? That's like Hamas's next target. And I was like, oh. Wow. So that was like kind of when it began.
Right. So before we break for... what happens after October 7th?
Yeah.
I was hoping you could read a poem a piece that you wrote that kind of went viral after October 7th, called Bad Jew.
Bad Jew. And this kind of explains my, thank you. This kind of kind of tells you the whole story.
So we'll hear you reading Bad Jew, and then we'll talk about what led to this.
Okay. Got it. I told my friend I was a Zionist, and immediately she looked unwell. If I had known Zionist was now code for white supremacist, I would have sat her down first. I would have whispered. I wouldn't have confessed my cultish ways in a bar in the heart of Manhattan. I wouldn't have allowed that long, awkward silence before I followed up with the now obligatory American Jewish explanation. I mean my definition of Zionism. I repeated it, hand over my heart like the national anthem, my definition of Zionism, the right for Israel to exist. I concluded with the lamest shit to ever come out of my Jewish mouth. I'm still the same me. It's unclear if I was trying to convince her or myself. I wanted her to remember it was me, the Jew who went to police brutality marches. It was me, the Jew that has spent her life fighting for equality. It is me, the Jew raising a Black, Jewish, Dominican daughter. Me, the good Jew. My Jewish pride has been on display since my first open mic, accepted, respected. I'll go as far as to say unique and entertaining. My unofficial bio has been, you gotta meet my girl Vanessa. She's Jewish, but I swear you would never know it. She's Jewish, but she's cool. She's Jewish, but she's a good Jew. I've surrendered to this, believing my mere presence in a sea of non-Jews would offset stereotypes. Growing up in the conscious age of hip hop, my Black and Latino friends were the driving force behind celebrating my identity. Their fists and flags in the air, I longed to know that fierce pride. Longed to know why I was white, but my grandmother spoke Arabic. Longed to immerse myself in other cultures while loving and honoring my own. And I did it. I made my mark, called the spoken word scene home. All the puzzle pieces fit until anyone mentioned Israel. Israel always threw a wrench in the works. Anytime there was an incident in Israel, there would be a week or so of Israel bashing, topped with a few anti-Semitic tropes in passing. But I kept on Jewing, kept on talking about Jewish pride and avoided Israel. And everyone would forget about Israel again until October 7th. By October 8th, my definition of Zionism was hijacked. By October 9th, I posted an Israeli flag on Instagram and lost followers. By October 10th, there were still no hopes and prayers for Israeli victims of terror. By October 11th, I saw things I couldn't unsee. By October 12th, I knew I could no longer be a good Jew, apologetic Jew, a Jew that has taken our homeland for granted, a Jew with a grandmother that ended up in New York but could have ended up in Israel, a Jew who now calls herself a Zionist and watches faces fall, a Zionist who some other artists won't be on the same bill with, a Zionist who knows that free speech is never so free as when it's hate speech against Jews, a Zionist who knows rape is not resistance, a Zionist that didn't think she could feel more proud of her people, a Zionist who confronted a white man ripping down hostage posters, a Zionist who was called a white supremacist in front of her black daughter, a Zionist who knew she needed to come to Israel to bear witness, to let them know we have your back, to apologize for being that American that only calls in emergencies, to tell you that what I've lost in people, I've gained in backbone. To tell you, I'm now a bad Jew, a once accepted Jew, a grieving Jew, a standing Jew, a politically homeless spoken word artist Jew, an awful, unapologetic, unwavering, proud till the fucking end Jew.
Wow. What? What prompted this? Where did this come from?
Absolute shock. Anger, betrayal, all of those things that I just couldn't, I couldn't avoid anymore. And I think that it was always a little, it kind of uncovered maybe things that I didn't want to still, that I didn't want to see. But it gave me an opportunity to be the realist me. And I have to say that, you know, it was a process in order to get to this piece because, I wanted to write about the way I was feeling, but I knew that saying the word Zionist would be, in the spoken word scene, it would be the nail in the coffin. And so I performed this piece in Israel, in Tel Aviv, at a spoken word place. I finished writing it that day. I performed it with the idea that I would never, ever read this in the United States of America. Saw that there had a video been taken of it, watched it for 2 months every day, knew that it was the most honest and raw thing I'd ever written in my life, and that if I didn't let it out there, it was only because of fear, and that I wouldn't be able to go to sleep at night and be true to myself if I didn't do it. And I also had a feeling, which I was right about, that there were other Jews that felt the same way and that were really scared to say it and that needed someone to say it. And I know that, you know, I've been given a gift and a voice and that I needed to be the one to say it, especially in this genre and especially in that world. And, you know, of course, it also came with a cost. And I mean, I had even Jewish friends that were like, are you sure you want to, you know, it's really, you keep saying Zionist, like you say it a lot of times in the piece. And I was like, yeah. And I have to say, Shai, you were definitely a inspiration for me because when I saw, you know, when I saw what was happening on campus, that was, you know, there were a few people that I watched that I was inspired by that kind of gave me the courage to get to where I am now. And
it takes a lot of courage to put something like this out. You're basically, you said it's a nail in the coffin.
Yeah.
I see this as coming out guns blazing.
Yeah.
It's not your coffin. It's other people's coffins. It's the scene's coffin. If they cannot accept this, if the word that offends you in this poem is Zionist and not fucking.
Right.
Something wrong with you. Not you, Vanessa, but you, the audience.
Yeah, and I had seen where it was going, where that word was going, and I also really felt, I never before October 7th walked around like, I'm a Zionist, Zionist this, Zionist that, and my bio is Zionist. Like, I didn't not claim that, but I didn't walk around and claim it. So it's funny, because the first time I went to Israel when I was 15 was with the American Zionist Youth Federation. Now, maybe that stuck with me. But when I saw the kids, and I believe it was at Columbia, that they had their hands clasped together and they were like, no Zionists, like past this point or something. I literally, like even now, I just felt like shivers down my spine. And I have a niece that's going to college next year. I have another niece who's another year or two behind her. I have a daughter. And I was like, well, you know, Vanessa, you've lived a pretty good life here as a Jew so far, but I do not want my nieces, my daughter, your kids to have to be anywhere and have to feel shame. And I resented this disconnect even within the Jewish community of Zionism and Jewish, because I really feel now, I can't get inside someone, but when I'm thinking about some of even the anti-Zionist Jews, when I try to get into their head of what they're thinking, I can't imagine that they would hear a chant like that and not feel something inside of them if they've grown up with any kind of connection to the community and knowing when you've grown up and Zionist is not a slur, how that feels. I've tried to find other words in other cultures. That's been my thing about like, what is a version of Zionist in another culture that someone would try to like hijack or something. And I really felt as though when I saw that, I said, no other group. This is total hypocrisy. There's no other group that this would happen to and that the general public would let this go on. There's no other group that would let them rip down posters of children.
Right. I mean, ironically, My favorite, used to be my favorite spoken word artist of all times. Now, not anymore because of things that he has said and done, but was Saul Williams.
Oh my God, I knew you were going to say that. Yeah.
And he has a poem or a piece where he talks about the N-word coming from Negro, Necro, Black, and being used against Black people and then reappropriating it.
Yeah.
And it's so ironic that someone like him, who I saw perform in Tel Aviv.
Wow. Yeah.
Would then do the exact same thing to someone else's identity.
Yeah.
I know what the reaction has been in the Jewish world for you reading this piece. What's it been in the non-Jewish world?
Well, putting it out online, I got messages that were, it's funny because the other day I save all of them. And I went through some of them again because some time had passed and I just wanted to reread some of them and kind of see, because one thing I've said to people is that I have never, ever in my life, and again, I haven't led this traditional life. I have, you know, a daughter, you know.
There's nothing traditional about you.
There's nothing traditional about me. Nothing except this has given, like, I've never had so much anger and just, like, fierce, I don't even know the word for it, like, come towards me as I have from saying I'm a Zionist. It's actually been fascinating because I cannot believe how it has made people so angry. And there's got to be something in that, you know?
But why? You know, and you've told me you've been heckled.
Yeah.
You know, you'd assume that in the progressive world, in the performing arts world, in the spoken word world, you'd have the most openness, the most acceptance, the most inclusivity. Why is it so hard?
Because I think that, and this is one of the things that I try to, which I think now people understand, but especially when I'm talking to Israelis about anti-Semitism here, I was listening to Coleman Hughes the other day, and he was talking about how there are different rivers of anti-Semitism. And, you know, when we grew up, it was a lot of it was like the Nazi right-wing anti-Semitism. The anti-Semitism that's in the left is a completely different river. And it's the reason why the progressive scene has latched on to this so much is because it has become like an issue of oppressor, oppressee, and a color race war. So what happened was, with this happening, not only was it a model of like what people were being like racism, like whites against blacks, Jews became like the worst kind of white people that could ever be. So being a Zionist was like white times like 1,000 in terms of like the kind of the anger that it would bring about. And a lot of that is one, I think just this underboiling of anti-Semitism that was always there. And then this gave it, you know, it empowered this new scene that came about after October 7th. It empowered people who already felt that way. I would say that unfortunately a lot with the, you know, the black community has been that this has been seen as like kind of mirroring the civil rights war in our country. And so it is seen that, you know, Israel white, Palestinians the black, and Israel is literally like on like the neck of that. And that image, you know, what we've had with George Floyd and everything, it's very strong. And so it has become that. And it's so hard to explain to people that it's a different model and that they're coming from a very Western lens with it. So I thought, at least when I wanted to reclaim Zionism, what I thought is, well, I've been performing in this scene for like 20 something years. People like me, they trust me. I'm like, if I do it, they're going to come to me and be like, wait a minute, you know, if Vanessa's calling herself this, maybe there's something to it and we should listen. So I kind of felt like I maybe could make a change because I wasn't the model of what they thought. Now I had maybe one or two people out of many that actually followed that route of then writing to me being like, hey, I'm really confused. You're calling yourself a Zionist and I'm hearing all this other stuff, blah, blah, blah. The rest of it was, how did we ever trust you in our circle? You're a white supremacist. How can you raise a black daughter? I mean, like it really became very personal.
Which is to me, like, I was taught, I don't know by whom, by the world, by my family, that any art piece ends with a question mark, not an exclamation point. It's a question mark of, what do you think? Can we have a conversation about this? And the few people that reached out to you, even if they ended up not agreeing with you, that was the point. The point that is...
It was, yeah.
For them to come and say, I don't see you as a bad Jew, but then I'm also hearing these things. Let's talk.
Yeah.
The anger, the hatred is something that I still cannot understand.
Yeah, I was really surprised that, I mean, I can't tell you how I'm still so shocked at that I was so immediately like cut off and canceled by certain people that literally I've spent 25 years performing with, being with, breaking bread with. I think it also became that it was so poisonous even for some of them to be associated with me, that became a problem too. And that's also one of the reasons why I did it so loudly, is because I started seeing things where artists were booked somewhere, and then closer to the event, there was like some kerfluffle about, oh, so-and-so now doesn't want to be on the panel because there's a Zionist on it, blah, 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 this and that. I really wanted to avoid that at all costs. And I was kind of like, anytime someone would book me, I was like, look, this is who I am. People can go on my, you know, profile. Like I felt this coming out that I wanted to have, because this was not a secret and this is not something that I was ashamed of. And I didn't want to, even the people that were booking me, I didn't want them to kind of not know what they were getting into. Right. And that's actually, you know, what happened, that I had my friend who has really been an ally and really believes in my work, hired me to perform at a Deaf Poetry Jam reunion show. And I had done two since October 7th. And I had told him, look, I think that we have to be prepared that someone might scream Free Palestine while I'm performing.
Which is, by the way, so weird, because there's nothing wrong with Free Palestine,
right,
in the context of Free Palestine next to a Free Israel.
Yeah.
But screaming Free Palestine at someone,
yeah,
who's not even Israeli,
yeah,
who's not even in Israel, who's a Jew, who believes that Israel has a right to exist, is incomprehensible.
Yeah, and I would say too that even if it was an Israeli, even if, I mean, like, there's this whole thing about, I mean, what I loved.
Right,
about,
I'm not saying that it would be okay, like, to do it for Israel, yeah, but I'm saying it's so far removed, and yet, yeah, the anger is so blinding.
I went so against the script that it was so shocking that I think that they didn't know what to do, to be honest with you. And I have to be honest with you, I did not perform this. This was not the piece that caused Free Palestine. I purposely didn't do this piece because I was like, I don't even think I'll make it through the first paragraph before, you know, there's a riot. So I chose other pieces that were really just dealing with what I had experienced since October 7th, with anti-Semitism, with being canceled, talking about the 1,200 of my people had been slaughtered. I said nothing negative about Gaza, about Palestinians. I really just talked from my point of view. I actually wrote a poem to my fellow Jews, which there were none in the audience, but I did it to my fellow Jews that I felt like had left the fight. You know, and I felt somewhat, you know, betrayed by, I called them, like, you know, the Oy Vey Jews, the Jews for the fun, kitschy Yiddish T-shirts. You know what I mean? But then when it comes down to the struggle, you know, where are you? Where are you? It's not only that. It's not all funny, cute, your little, you know, your funny friend with a self-deprecating humor. It's like there's the struggle. And I took it personally that there were a lot of people who especially promoted themselves in their art being Jewish and, you know, then didn't kind of stand up when this happened. I didn't call anyone out personally. It was just a matter of that. And that was what they screamed. I purposely left out the word Zionist in my set that night, which I wasn't so sure about. I think I had told you before I was going to do it. I had seen you the week before that show. But I said, let me just start here, you know what I mean, and see where the conversation goes. Well, that was where it went. But what was really interesting, and I do want to say on a positive note, aside from those people that heckled me, there were numerous audience members that came up to me, not Jewish, of all colors, of all religions. I had a Black Muslim woman. I had men at all ethnicities, ages, come over to me and thank me for doing the poems and for showing a different point of view And they were actually, some of them were kind of surprised that there was even that reaction. Some people weren't, I don't even know what they thought or if they agreed with me, but they were just like, you're fucking brave. Like, holy shit. Like, and it was like a respect. And I didn't care. I didn't care that it was if they agreed with me or not. Other people were just like, are you all right? And I'm like, yeah, I'm good. They're like, okay. But the people that were most angry were my fellow performers and the people who heckled me. And the thing that I realized afterwards was with my fellow performers was that it wasn't really what I said. It was what I didn't say. And they were very, they felt, first of all, I got the note that they didn't understand why all my pieces had to be so pointed, which was very interesting to me because that's the genre of spoken word, is pointed. All their pieces were pointed.
But they weren't pointed by a Jew.
And this is when the hypocrisy for me came full circle, where I had tested it out and not just made assumptions about did people want to have free speech and have conversation, but in real time experienced that. Mm. And the fact that they said that I didn't mention starving children, that I didn't mention genocide, they felt as though I was excluding something.
So I assume many of them also spoke, you know, about pieces that were controversial. Let's say talking about police brutality. Do they also mention the countless positive police officers? Talking about, you know, homophobia. Do they also like there's that in itself is already the double standard that you are being criticized for what you did not say.
It was very much that. And I knew, and I mean, people can tell me, you know, look, I don't know if I could prove it in a court of law, but I will say that if it had been a Palestinian poet that had gotten up and done a set and not mentioned the hostages, no one would have been screaming and been upset. And so that was where I just felt as though it made people uncomfortable. And so they tried to find a way to kind of what I was doing wrong, other than the script that I was putting out there was not used, it was so alien to the spoken word scene. And in a way, I honestly didn't even know. I think I was so far gone in my world. And it's a good thing that I didn't realize it, because maybe if I realized I was going to be, you know, that provocative, I would have been more scared, but I wasn't. And they were two people after me that were upset by it mentioned that I had said 1,200 people had been slaughtered. And it became kind of like a numbers thing, like, how dare you kind of mention that when so many Palestinians, and again, I said nothing that was against, you know, anything with peace or about Palestinians. Like, they wouldn't know what my view is on, you know, going forward, what I think should be a solution, if I even had one. But it was that it wasn't.
It's a literal Jews don't count.
It was just like too much Jew. It was too much. It was just way, way too much Jew, too much proud Jew, too much unapologetic Jew. And, you know, I don't think anyone, they would admit that, but I feel like I've been in the scene long enough that I could see, you know, I know that scene. I know how it works.
Vanessa, I want to end on a positive note,
yeah.
Not a negative note.
Yeah.
Well, despite the darkness out there. What's next for you? What does the future hold for you?
Well, I'm going back to Israel in a few weeks. And I'm really excited because the first time I went was right after October 7th. And I felt like that was just like literally just going to the sites of where all of these, you know, atrocities happened and taking that in and kind of just feeling from Israelis, like what they wanted me to take back to the States. Now I feel as though this is an amazing, this this opportunity of where we are as Jews right now, as a peoplehood, through something horrible, we have an opportunity to become more united. And I have become so much more united with my community. I feel like I've let down a lot of my preconceptions about other denominations of Jews. Like, I feel a lot more open to us as a whole people. And we have an opportunity for diaspora Jews and Israeli Jews to come together more. And we need each other after what has happened. And so I'm hoping this trip, I feel like I want it to be about that dialogue and for them understanding the diaspora point of view of where we are, and for me understanding the Israeli point of view and how we can come in and help each other, because, you know, we're in a crisis. But, oh, sorry, that wasn't positive.
But it is positive because it, is about building.
And I will say that, you know, I talked about a lot of the negative stuff that I have received, but the amount of love that I've received, not only from the Jewish community, but, you know, from a few handpicked, you know, some allies that have, my surprising allies that have just come and embraced me and stood by me, have been amazing. And I just feel so incredibly lucky to get to know them in that. So there are those people.
Other.
Yeah, there are those people out there that will support us, and, you know, we'll find our way. And none of it, I regret nothing. Could be my tagline, regret nothing.
I regret nothing. That's going to be the episode's title. So I'm going to end with the Here I Am lightning round.
Oh, okay.
A series of rapid fire questions. There's no right or wrong answer.
Okay, okay.
It's the first thing that comes to mind.
All right.
And I think that after that, we'll maybe hear you read out loud another piece.
Sure.
All right.
Yay.
So everyone stick around. Vanessa Hidari, what is one thing people don't know about you?
Well, I kind of gave it away in the thing, but then I'm a huge old school hip hop fan and know the lyrics to a lot of songs that people probably would be surprised at if you see me out at a bar and something comes on. I know a lot about old school hip hop.
All right, we're gonna get some drinks into you. In the bar. What is one thing people don't know about the Jews?
That we are a diverse people. I mean, I can't stress enough how we have to start, the education has to start going towards explaining the diversity of our people. It's so important.
What is your favorite curse? Any language you want.
I feel like, God damn it. Or Jesus, I'm trying to think of one thing that I said that my daughter kept asking me about, but God damn it, that comes from my dad. And Jesus Christ, I don't know who that comes from, but those are two. That's probably like, those are such American curses, right? Yeah. That's what.
When was the last time you cried?
When was the last time I cried? That's a really good question. Probably the day that the hostages came home.
The living hostages.
Yeah. Yeah, and I would say since then, I've had, again, moments of, I've rewatched those videos so many times, like many of us, it's like on repeat, and that's when I've cried.
If you could have any Jewish person over for Shabbat dinner from any moment in history, dead or living, who would that be?
Oh, my God. Can it be like a little table of people?
Let's go.
Okay. Well, we already had Shabbat together, so I've lived out that fantasy. They're all living, because these are people who have inspired me the past year. And I'm putting this out to the universe because they're living and it could happen. It could happen. Haviv Redinger, love him. He's been such an inspiration for me over these 2 years. Inat Wilf, Yossi Klein Halevi, and Rabbi Amiel Hirsch.
What a loud Shabbat dinner. Wow.
I have learned so...
You're not going to get a warden.
I don't care. They have been... I have put myself into learning in the past, you know, year or two. And they've really... Sometimes, it, like, you know, when you're really sad, sometimes knowledge can... I never knew that before, really, this. This, in you know, this, because with, like, other things, it didn't really work that way. But with this, I would put on Chaviv and watch something, and I'd feel better. Mm. I'd feel empowered, and I learned, and you know.
And people don't know, Chaviv translates to likable.
Really? So, I did not know that.
What is your favorite Jewish holiday?
Pesach.
What is your least favorite Jewish holiday?
God, do I even have one? I feel like it's so not a bad holiday, but I never got into Sukkot with the lulav and the, you know what I mean? Like, I didn't want the prop. Mm-hmm. So it was just like too much, but so, and it came right after other things. So I was just like, no, we don't need that.
When do you feel safest?
When I'm with my daughter, shout out to Ariella, my daughter. When I'm with my daughter, putting her to sleep at night.
When do you feel least safe?
When I post something on Instagram. No, I don't even feel not safe. I would say that sometimes now, and it's really sad to say, but sometimes going to like a certain event, like it took me a few weeks, but the hostage marches, I was so anxious the first few times that I went. And then I feel like I eased into it, but I felt like we were such a little target in this big park and with the flags and everything. It was, I was like this the whole time, like looking around. And then after three times going, I calmed down, but I felt very unsafe.
What gives you hope?
My daughter, that she will grow up and be the embodiment of all of this change, and that we can be, you know, I mean, I want the unity back. I don't know how it's going to happen yet, and it's been so hard to not know the answers of how to do something because I was always a bridge builder. And I feel for the first time, like, how am I going to get these communities together? And I just want her to be the living, you know, experience of that.
I believe in your little Juminica.
My little Juminicana, yeah.
Finally, every episode, I urge the listeners to donate to one charity that does good in Israel, the Jewish diaspora, or the world in large. Where would you want listeners to donate to this week?
Oh, my God. Damn it, I didn't prepare this one. I don't know a name of an organization, but I feel very much that it should be towards like the PTSD mental health of what's happening in Israel with, you know, people who are survivors and soldiers because of what we've seen lately. And I feel like now we're starting to see the ramifications of a lot of the trauma and absolutely needs. I wish I was a trained therapist so when I go over there, I could be doing a side thing or whatever, but I don't know if they want me to do that.
I would add, so for that, Natal, NATAL, they do PTSD and trauma support for
then
civilians. And Brothers for Life do the same for soldiers.
Yeah, that's what I believe in right now.
Vanessa Hidari, where can people find you?
I'd say most active these days on Instagram, Vanessa Hidari. I'm the only one, Hidary. Hidari, however you want to say it. I'm the only one, so you'll find me there and on Facebook. So I'd say social media has become, you know.
All right. Well, we're going to listen to one more piece of yours that is called, what is it called?
Oh, this is a short one. Okay.
But before I do, I just want to say I am so, so glad that you came here. And before we listen to the poem, here I am with Vanessa Hidari.
if something should happen to me in a Jewish space, being a Jew, don't tell them I was a good one. Don't tell them I was different and deserved to be spared. Don't tell them I was there doing peace work and therefore worthy. Don't tell them I wasn't a Zionist. Don't tell them anything other than I lived as a proud Jew till my very last breath.
Wow. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Michael Greenspan, Shai's father-in-law. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Here I Am podcast with Shai Davidai. Here I Am is recorded at The Cave Production House in Hackensack, New Jersey, and is brought to you in partnership with Abby Sophia and Adamit Productions. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'd also like to extend my deepest gratitude to everyone at Adamit Productions for turning Shai's dream into a reality, and to all our donors and partners for their unwavering commitment to fighting for Jewish civil rights. Most importantly, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. Let's be honest, none of this would have been possible without your support and dedication. Showing up is half the battle. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being there. Thank you for saying, "Here I am."